One of the things I learned in my career is that individual contributors are much more powerful when they're not actually individual contributors, when you surround them with lots of smart people. So surround yourself with smart people and you will do much greater things than as an individual.
Welcome to the Disruptive Innovators Champions of Digital Business podcast, where IT and digital leaders from around the world talk about their careers, their inspiration, and their vision for the future of digital business. I'm your host, David Wright. The world of digital business is evolving faster than ever, and I want this to be a place where digital business champions create a village to band together and help each other navigate the ever-changing terrain. Disruptive Innovators features conversations with CIOs and digital leaders from around the world, diving into their personal backstory, career, their current role, trends they've been seeing, and their vision for the future, personally, professionally, and otherwise. This podcast is made for people who are seeing how quickly the digital business landscape is evolving. Those who recognize that it takes a village of trusted advisors to navigate this ever-changing terrain. People who enjoy listening to high-level discussions surrounding what it means to be a leader, real-world examples of challenges faced, and industry-specific strategies leveraged to create exceptional business outcomes. This episode is brought to you by Disruptive Innovations, a leading tech consulting firm that helps enterprise organizations with their IT strategy, process optimization, and workflow improvement. Contact them and find out more at disruptiveinnovations.net.
Good morning, friends. David Wright here, and I'm your host of the Disruptive Innovators Champions of Digital Business podcast. And today, I am lucky enough to be joined by Stephen Brooks. Stephen, it's a pleasure to have you on.
Great to be on board.
Yeah, absolutely. I know it's a long time in the making. Stephen, for those of our listeners who just may not be familiar, I know you have a really awesome history, but currently, can you tell everybody a little bit about where you are today?
Sure. I recently joined Ab Initio Software, which is a privately held company. And I can think of it as a spinoff out of MIT. A lot of the founders were from MIT. I was also at MIT, and it's a really interesting place to work. Very innovative, very engineering focused. I'm chief technology officer, so I have responsibility for really working with the team to develop technology strategy and then bring the technology to our customers.
Absolutely. Yeah, I'm really psyched and honored to be speaking today. So, Stephen, we like to just start the episode off with one piece of actionable advice you might look to leave everyone with today.
People matter. One of the things I learned in my career is that individual contributors are much more powerful when they're not actually individual contributors, when you surround them with lots of smart people. So surround yourself with smart people and you will do much greater things than as an individual.
Love that advice. My mom, who I always talk about on the podcast, she's the president and CEO of a nonprofit. She always used to tell me, I need to hire people that are smarter than me. So that's what I strive to do myself.
There's a saying a friend of mine says that A players attract other A players, B players attract C players. So you got to surround yourself with A players and you get more and more, builds a critical mass. And that's one of the things I love about Ab Initio Software. Every day, I just get amazed by the smart people that I end up working with and having random conversations in the hallway or in the cafe. And it makes it a pleasure to be at work every single day and work with smart customers, make you smarter. So it's good.
Love that. So Stephen, let's talk a little bit about your backstory. So tell us a little bit about how you started out and how you got to the point that you're at in your career today.
I was born and bred in Silicon Valley, back before it was Silicon Valley, one of the few. And a turning point for me was I got a summer internship at Lawrence Livermore National Laboratory. And there was a guy there, George Michael, who's a brilliant physicist. And he built this high-speed computing group where he put together amazing scientists, physicists, and chemists, and so on, together with computer scientists. And so I was on the computer science side. I was doing my undergraduate at University of California, Berkeley. And he got me very interested in high-speed computing and working with humongous data sets and solving big problems. And that motivated me to apply for the PhD program at MIT, and I ended up getting in and going back east. And I've always been a very hands-on person. And so I was working with high-speed computing. My PhD research was around high-speed computing, but I don't want to do just theoretical work. But the science labs on the West Coast were much more interesting than the science labs on the East Coast. So I couldn't get my hands on really interesting problems to solve that were like close without flying to Los Alamos or Livermore and so on. We had a lot of research collaboration with these labs, but the closest place where there were really high-speed computers solving really interesting problems. And so I ended up from Boston going back and forth to Wall Street, side gig building real-time trading systems, early days of quantitative trading systems. You're using advanced math to do signal detection, decide when to buy and sell and all that kind of stuff. And it was really cool stuff. And so I shifted from purely scientific computing to what I would call more commercial computing in the financial world. And then I just started working with larger and larger data sets and ended up working with Nielsen, who collects all of the point of sales data from every retailer in North America, actually in the world, and combining that with the data that they got from the television ads and television viewership and so on. So there's Nielsen ratings for television that most people know, but there's also, they do coupon tracking, they do point of sales tracking, so huge amounts of data. So I was part of the team that sort of brought that all together. When I say part of the team, I was a consultant, so I was still doing my PhD and doing these as kind of side gigs to support my travel habit. Evolved into what we now call data warehousing and big data and all these words that are very popular these days. And it was interesting because another turning point was in my PhD, you're required at MIT to have a minor program. And my attitude was, I'm here for the PhD. I don't want to waste my time on this minor program. So I signed up for mathematics. And the reason I did that is because as an undergrad, I had taken a ton of mathematics. I didn't have a math degree because I had an engineering degree, and math and engineering were in two different colleges at UC Berkeley. So you couldn't easily get a double degree across colleges. So I'd taken a ton of math, and I figured I'd just slide through those classes as part of my minor program. But my academic advisor actually had looked at my undergraduate transcripts, which they never do. And he looked at it and said, no, wait a minute, you've already taken all the classes. You can't do that. And I said, what am I going to do that doesn't have huge reading lists and labs and things like that? I want this to be like minimum time waster. Don't want to be distracted from my PhD. So the answer was take business classes, right? That's it. Do case studies and so on. Case studies are 10 to 15 pages. You read it. You sit around the class. You argue with each other. Sounds like fun and not that much work. And so the minor program had, we had to take, I don't remember how many classes, but it wasn't that many. But then I started liking it. And then there was cross-registration between MIT and Harvard. So I could take all the Harvard, my business classes at the Harvard Business School. And that became very interesting. And so I ended up just doing the MBA. My PhD advisor, of course, was very disappointed in, because it means I was not going to go into academia and become a professor. And that's what typically they want you to do, because it helps build their credibility when their students become academics, et cetera. So that was a couple turning points. George Michael and the labs at Lawrence Livermore and getting me involved in high-speed computing, then going to MIT, and then taking this turn into the commercial world, and then doing a bunch of startup companies coming out of MIT. MIT is a very much a startup culture. And right. So I did a bunch of startup companies. So one got acquired by IBM, did a couple of IPOs, and now I'm at Ab Initio, which is privately held. It's not exactly a startup company. It's been around for a while, but it's definitely got a startup attitude and a startup vibe in terms of how we work with each other and how we work with customers.
Love it. Love the startup vibe. We have that over here. So I hear it. I'm here for it. What would you say, really interesting kind of turn of events as you went? And I love that you just kept moving, like, you know, and kind of let the universe guide you based on really what you're interested in. What would you say, Stephen, was one of the most important things that you learned over the course of your journey?
Other than the people thing that I already mentioned, I would say happiness doesn't come with stuff. So I am a complete minimalist. I tell people I travel just once a year, just lasts all year. So I travel all the time. I prefer to invest in experiences and travel, not stuff. Don't own a house, don't own a car. Then there are no cats, no dogs, no plants, no apartment, just complete freedom. And that for me is, that creates happiness, right? And it's about people. So people, don't you have a home? I said, home is wherever I am. And it's really about the people that I spend time with. And although I travel all the time, I tend to see my closest friends. I see them no matter where they are in the world, I'll make sure to spend time with them. So,
yeah, I love that. My wife and I are largely the same way. You know, she's not a handbag type of person. She wants like the experience, something that we can go do together. And there's a book by another Harvard guy. He talks about the Striver's Curse. What is it? From Strength to Strength. Basically, just like what you just mentioned brings up for me is the fact that if I'm striving for status or stuff, or there's always like the next, I'm never going to be satisfied. I always want, and this was something that I fell prey to early on in my career. And honestly, up until just a few years ago, there was a pivotal time in my life where I flipped the script and really just started focusing on being of service in the world and human connection, which is part of, I believe, a part of what you're saying, that kind of experiential. And the other stuff as needed, as was taken care of. If I needed some money to support myself, or we needed to grow as a company, when I started focusing on being of service, the rest of its stuff just seemed to take care of itself, which is interesting.
Yeah, but you say about being satisfied. Actually, at some level, I don't want to be satisfied because that leads to complacency, right? So right. I have this philosophy in life that every month I should do at least one thing on my bucket list. Every month, not next year, every month I do at least one thing on my bucket list. And then every month I should put at least one new thing on the bucket list, because the bucket list goes to zero. That's a bad idea, right? So never being satisfied, always creating new goals, incremental, realistic goals, and so on. That's true. And you know this bucket list thing, but it's also true in the technology world, right? Always trying to push the boundaries and do greater and greater things. It's one of the things I like about ab initio is that it's very much focused on solving the most complex problems, right? The problems that everybody else ran away from, we run toward them, and creates a very interesting culture that every day you're solving something that it's making a big impact on some enterprise, on some customer that we're working with. And so not being satisfied is actually okay. That's different than not being happy.
You should
always be happy and create these sort of incremental goals that you're achieving. Don't get complacent.
Yeah, I agree. No, I agree with that 100%. What about, Stephen, a time that you either failed or that you had a hardship personally, professionally, or otherwise, but you ultimately took away a lesson from it, something that was profound or pivotal in your journey?
Yeah, I grew up in California. I had never been east of the Goat Canyon Trestle Bridge in Southern California. It's the Eastern Desert near San Diego, and jumped on a plane, went to MIT. I remember they wanted me to do a campus visit and so on. And I said, no, I'm not going to campus visit. I don't care what the campus looks like. I'm coming there for academics and so on. So I basically went sight unseen. Probably a good thing, because if I had looked at that campus and then compared it to the campus at Berkeley and Stanford, which are a much more beautiful campus, I might have changed my mind, but not really. I was going there for the academics. The problem I had is when I went there, I just wasn't used to East Coast culture, right? They're just not the same level of friendly, right? In California, I'm walking down the street, you see someone, you say hello. You don't have to know them. You just say hello because it's a nice thing to do. And I remember every day I walked across the Mass Ave Bridge between Boston and Cambridge, at least twice a day, sometimes four times a day. And I would just say hello to people I'm passing on the bridge. And sometimes you see the same people multiple times, right? Because there's been a pattern. And they put their heads down. They never respond. And this is just depressing. And I felt very isolated. I came to MIT. I didn't know anybody. I didn't have any friends in Boston. Grew up my whole life in California. And that was tough. And I had to find my people, right? And that was very important. My first semester at MIT, I was actually not particularly happy. Part of the reason I wasn't happy was because there was a different culture at Berkeley and MIT. At Berkeley, the academic ethics are you do your own work. You do your own work and you turn in that work, and it's about sort of individual achievement and so on. At MIT, more than 50% of the grad students actually came from MIT undergrad. And so they already knew these, the rules were a little bit different at MIT, that they pile on so much work, you can't survive if you just do it by yourself. So they collaborate. People get together and they solve problems in teams, but I had no idea. And here I was plowing through these problem sets, working my ass off. And I, at Berkeley, I was top of every class and so on. At MIT, I was just like, I felt very mediocre. Why is this happening? What's going on here? I know these guys are really smart. What is going on? And it took me through the first semester to understand, so here I am tooling away in the library on my own. And then on the eighth floor, there's a group of seven people solving the same problem that I'm trying to solve by myself. And that teamwork was in the ethics that I learned at Berkeley. That was cheating. But at MIT, that's just the way things are done. But if you look at the way the real world works, it's not about individuals solving problems. It's about groups of people solving problems. And, and that was a hard lesson for me to learn because I had been taught academically very differently. But then once I understood, then the learning accelerated, the connections accelerated. I eventually became an RA in an undergraduate dormitory and then get very embedded in the life. And that first semester at MIT was not very pleasant, but from then on, it was amazing, right? I just had to make the connections. And again, it's about the people, it's about the connections and not about individual achievement. It's about team achievement.
Yeah, no, I love that. And it's so true because even if I could solve a given problem, if I'm bringing different perspectives to the table from different vantage points that I may have not have known, I didn't even know, I'm going to get to the solution that much quicker.
There's an important point in what you just said. The diversity of the people is important, right? So when I assemble teams, I try to bring a lot of diversity to the team, right? Gender diversity, ethnic diversity, different universities, different age groups. The more diversity you have, the more different perspectives, as you said, that you bring to the table. And it leads to this, you know, sometimes there's a little bit of conflict. And actually, when you're problem solving, conflict's not a bad thing, right? You're fighting over the right way to do things. And usually the answer is some combination of these different perspectives, which is much better than if everybody's thinking the same.
Right. Yeah, I totally agree. I want to talk a little bit more about your current role, Stephen. Before we do, I always just to ask, imagine you've read a number of books over your time. Favorite book either that you've been reading as of late, recently, or all time, your choice?
That's tough. I'm a voracious reader, so I've got lots and lots of favorite books. But
I figured.
Recently, one of the books that I liked is The Narrow Corridor. It's by the same author, an MIT economist, actually, who comes from Turkey. His name is Darren Acemoglu. He also wrote Why Nations Fail. And it talks about the balance needed between sort of a dictatorship is probably not the right thing. And a total democracy also doesn't always work. We're the populist politics kind of thing. So where is the narrow corridor between those two things? And he talks about places like Singapore, which is an amazing success story. And arguably it's a, you know, benevolent dictatorship. They probably wouldn't say that, but it is not a democracy in the same way that the US would consider itself a democracy. And so you see, then you talk about, okay, that's fine for a little small island state, but how do you scale that up? And so there's a lot of interesting discussion in the book about getting the right balance between authoritative decision-making and leading versus the populist politics and so on. So it's a particularly timely set of thoughts as we approach the 2024 elections later on this year. So yeah, not to drag us into politics, by the way, but I went to my politics.
No, I love it. Very cool. I'm sure I could ask you about a few other recommendations offline, so I'll plan to do that. So, Stephen, let's talk about your current role. Talk to us a little bit about your vision for the organization, some of the things you're working on. I know you mentioned you're solving some complex problems, what you can share given commitments to privacy and all that. But just curious to learn a little bit more about what you guys are up to.
Sure. So my view is data is the fuel for the modern economy. And in Silicon Valley, we have this saying that we repeat, in the 21st century, all companies either are data companies, will be data companies, or will be extinct. And so we look at all of this AI mania that's going on right now with generative AI and so on. Data is the fuel for the pervasive deployment of AI and machine learning. And this takes a lot of sophistication to curate the raw data in the data products that create value, because the raw data by itself is not particularly usable. You have to curate it and really create data products. And what I see is the mission for Ab Initio software is to provide the best capabilities with robust governance for taking data from its raw form into data products at extreme scalability with extreme reliability, and doing that in the cloud, which is where most of the innovation takes place right now. So these are some of the keys. There's a whole bunch of technical detail below that, but I think your audience probably doesn't want to know about open table formats and containerization, so I won't go there.
We've gone down the rabbit hole a couple of times. That sounds super cool. What about some of the key challenges you guys are facing as an organization?
One of the big barriers to widespread adoption of AI ML is transparency. There's incredible value being created. My belief is that AI ML will be embedded in every single business process at scale, in real time, operationalized, absolutely critical. But if people, humans, don't trust the AI, then it's going to get blocked. And more than can we get it to perform a little bit better, or can we get it to be more accurate, it's can we make it more transparent? Can we measure bias and eliminate bias? Can we explain how the decisions get made? And as we move toward more sophisticated mathematics with multi-layer neural networks and so on, it becomes increasingly opaque. So Ab Initio software provides a level of governance where you can see the lineage and where the data is coming from and all the transformations that are done and how missing data is repaired, and then measuring the accuracy and measuring the bias and so on. These are all capabilities of the software. And we want to make these capabilities available not just to PhDs in computer science with a low-code, no-code solution that a mere human can use in order to create these solutions for enterprises. So it's not just the big monster organizations can do that in these small departments of think tanks in the ivory tower, but rather democratize access to the data and make sure that we're eliminating the technical debt associated with a lot of the data pipelines that have historically been in organizations that have been cobbled together. So a key point of success is we need to move towards an approach where AI ML is, I'll call it, an artisanal trade by a few really good experts and so on, to one that's more industrialized, that can be deployed at scale. And that requires a lot more transparency and automation and scalable, repeatable processes. And that's what our software brings to the table. And it's changing the game in large banks and telecommunications companies and retailers and so on, so that a wider audience across multiple parts of the enterprise can use the data in more sophisticated ways.
Yeah, it's so necessary. And I think you're addressing a huge problem right now. It's that kind of black box mentality. What's going on behind the curtain? It's a fear, I think, of per a lack of understanding and education. So it's great that you guys can create that level of clarity for people. That'll be huge. Because I agree. I think in the next 5 years, it'll just be so pervasive, but it will be necessary to do the types of things that you guys are doing. Even I have a buddy out of Austin, Initio, as a company that, like, because there's certain companies that have data scientists and they don't have a way to track how they're working on algorithms. And basically, God forbid that individual just like leaves or gets hit by a bus. Like, how are you figuring out? It's not as simple as just like a line of code, right? Like if you're, yeah, just all of this it's super interesting to me.
That's a good example that you're giving of tech debt, where right. You know, that piece of code that only one person understands, that's high operational risk and tech debt to the company. And very often people use, you know, a description of what's going on and, you know, some kind of documentation. But as soon as you document something, it's already out of date before you finish the document, because you're going to make changes to the data, the algorithm, and so on. And if these things aren't synchronized totally together, then it's a lose-lose situation. So this is what I call a passive approach to metadata. So metadata is this idea of data about the data. How do you describe the data that you have and all the transformations and so on? The approach that we take is referred to as active metadata, where the metadata actually defines what's happening, but it's not passive documentation after the fact, it actually defines what's happening. In order to change the execution, you actually drive it from the metadata. So it's a very different approach that is much, much more powerful. It also leads to this low code, no code situation where you don't have to be a coding expert. And one of the challenges in the industry is you've got this kind of Silicon Valley resume building where everybody wants to use the latest, greatest technology and create a very highly scarce skill set for getting things done. And these are the artisanals that are doing job protection. And really what our goal is to democratize and let everybody have access to the data and make it a much freer world for accessing the data. And that's why open table formats is important. That's why low code, no code is important in order to, again, democratize access to data, democratize these capabilities within the industry.
Yeah, I love it. My wheels are turning. That's why I paused for a moment. I was just thinking about almost like prompts in OpenAI is almost like a level as the metadata and like kind of the descriptor, like that being the way to describe. Stephen, that's super, super interesting. So we have a little bit of time left here. One question I would ask, and you described it, but where do you see the software development industry and or the future kind of this industry? What do you think will be some of the biggest changes as time passes surrounding AI, data, and that sort of thing? I think you alluded to some of them, but curious.
Yeah, I think the key points there are embedded in every single business process, real-time, up-to-date data. These systems for decision-making are becoming operational mission critical. So the early days of data warehousing and big data were often not operational. You had this idea of, okay, you've got decision-making systems and operational systems, but increasingly operational systems are decision-making systems. And so we have to change our way of thinking about things. And my approach as CTO is very much an outside-in approach. I know some CTOs, they like to spend a lot of time in the labs, dream up great ideas, and then go look for a problem to solve with their technology. At Ab Initio, we do it really a different way. We get very close to our customer outside in and they say, okay, given where the customer is, given where they want to go, what is the technology that's going to help them? And then designing that from first principles. So if your Latin's a little bit rusty, you may not know that Ab Initio means in Latin from the beginning or from first principles. And that's how we approach the building of the software. This outside-in approach, very closely aligned to customers, and then looking for what are going to be the barriers for embedding AI ML in every single business process. And that gets us very quickly to this idea of strong governance, transparency, democratization. These are the problems that we're looking to solve.
Yeah, no, very cool. Very cool. So Stephen, this has been awesome. Really appreciate having you on today. The last question I would have for you is if you could go back 5, 10, 20 years in time, what advice would you give your younger self?
So even 20 years is not that young for me, but I'll turn the clock back and I will tell you, admit to you that I was 27 years old before the first time that I traveled outside of North America. And that was waiting too long. You know, my advice is travel more. Have less stuff, get out of your comfort zone. And one of my favorite things to do when I travel is get lost. That sounds a little bit strange, but I see people like in the souks of Morocco with their Lonely Planet guides and turn left, turn right, and so on. They see the same stuff that everybody else sees. And leave the guidebook at home, meet local people, get lost, stay with local people. Don't stay in Marriott hotels and so on. Stay with local people, have local experiences. Get lost. I've never been permanently lost. It's okay. You always find yourself and you'll have amazing experiences. The travel experiences that you remember are not going to be the click that you took of the Eiffel Tower or something like that. It's going to be about people and experiences that were not planned and just happened. And to make that happen, you have to get lost. And that's my approach also to innovation. You have to get lost in the problem and follow the tangents. And you don't know exactly where you're going. You've got this idea of what good looks like. And I don't know what it is, but I'll know it when I see it. that kind of thing. And that's good for innovation. It's also good for life experiences. And make a habit of getting lost in the problems that you solve in your innovation, as well as in your life and travel and so on. Don't overplan.
Yeah, no, I love that. Stephen, such a pleasure having you on. Thank you so much for your insight and experience today.
Sure. My pleasure. My pleasure.
And to our listeners, thank you all for tuning in, and we will catch you all next week.
Thank you for listening to the Disruptive Innovators Champions of Digital Business podcast. If you enjoyed this episode, please leave a 5-star review and subscribe to enjoy future episodes. This episode is brought to you by Disruptive Innovations, a leading tech consulting firm that helps enterprise organizations with their IT strategy, process optimization, and workflow improvement. Contact them and find out more at disruptiveinnovations.net.